welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from the News and Observer, from the Washington Post, from the Associated Press, and more. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we're going to get started today because there's a lot to go over, none of which involves the election. I promise you there will be no election-related stories on today's program. We'll begin with an article published October 28th in the News and Observer entitled, As More Churches Gather in Person, NC Officials Worry About COVID-19 Cluster Risk. And I will mention that this was written before the election, so it mentions a campaign rally, but in the context of a broader point about religious gatherings. This is by Martha Quillen of the News and Observer. Religious events such as worship services, Bible studies, and youth group meetings have become the third leading source of known COVID-19 cluster infections in North Carolina, as some churches test different ways of regathering in a pandemic. At least 1,180 cases of COVID-19 have been connected with 88 clusters of illness traced to religious events across the state, the Department of Health and Human Services said Monday. At least 18 people have died with COVID-19 in association with those clusters, the state said. Colleges and universities account for 1,959 cases of infection through 175 clusters, which the state says have resulted in no deaths. Meat and poultry processing plants have been connected with 3,842 infections through just 39 clusters, resulting in 19 deaths. The state has added information about clusters to its weekly reporting, but a spokeswoman for the department said the reporting is incomplete. In part, this is due to the fact that many COVID-19 cases are never diagnosed or cannot be linked to a specific setting or specific cluster, Katie Armstrong, a press assistant at DHHS, said in an email to the News and Observer. Additionally, while congregate living settings, schools, and child care are required to report clusters or outbreaks to their local health departments, other settings are not required to report in the same manner. Thus, the cluster data provided in this report is limited to clusters that have been voluntarily reported or identified through case investigation and contact tracing efforts. State health officials define a cluster as 5 or more cases with positive test results or illness onset within a 14-day period with a plausible epidemiological link and where there is not a more likely source of exposure. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has recently updated its information about exposure risk, saying that a person can be infected by being within 6 feet of an infected person multiple times, totaling 15 minutes over 24 hours. The state's reporting on clusters distinguishes religious gatherings from social gatherings, which include funerals, weddings, parties, and family reunions, though all fall into the category of community living and events. So far, 24 clusters with 236 cases of COVID-19, two of them fatal, have been connected to social gatherings. According to the state report, clusters soared the weeks of September 27th, October 4th, and October 11th. One of the largest clusters associated with religious gatherings has been United House of Prayer for All People in Mecklenburg County. Health officials there ordered the church to close after 121 cases of COVID-19, and at least 3 deaths were connected with convocation events held October 4th through the 11th, and drawing up to 1,000 people each, the Charlotte Observer reported. The church had planned to go forward with a week-long revival before the health department took action. In addition to releasing information about clusters, the state has produced a toolkit for faith leaders with 10 steps to help reduce the spread of illness. Among other things, it asks pastors to encourage their congregations to wear masks, maintain social distance and wash or sanitize hands, ask church members to get tested if they think they've been exposed, host a testing event, and encourage people to participate in contact tracing. Most churches in North Carolina halted in-person events and went to online worship services, meetings, and study groups shortly after COVID-19 hit the state in March. But some balked at being told not to gather for church when large numbers of people were allowed to roam the aisles of home improvement and big-box department stores unrestricted. 2 Baptist churches, a pastor, and a revival group sued Governor Roy Cooper on First Amendment grounds in May, and a federal judge said churches must be allowed to gather. The court trusts worshipers and their leaders to look after one another and society while exercising their free exercise rights just as they and their fellow citizens, whether religious or not, do when engaged in non-religious activities, Judge James C. Deaver III wrote in his order. Cooper chose not to appeal. A few churches across the state resumed in-person worship then, but most stayed closed during the summer. In recent weeks, since Cooper allowed the state to move to reopening Phase 3, more churches began holding services in person, first in their parking lots and then indoors using online reservation systems to limit the number of people, roping off seating areas to guarantee social distancing, and taking other recommended preventive steps. Pastor Michael Stevens said his church, Franklin Church of God, followed health officials' guidance when it reopened in the summer. The sanctuary, which can accommodate up to 400 people, was limited to keep family groups 6 feet apart. Masks were strongly encouraged. There was no congregational singing. No collection plate was passed. After the service, people were released by rows and prevented from lingering to talk. And still, a couple weeks ago, Stevens said, a member of the Macon County Church was exposed to COVID-19 at work. The illness spread to his family members and then to others at church, infecting a total of 8 or 9 people, qualifying as a cluster. The church shut down immediately, Stevens said, and won't go back into the building until there are no active cases. Even then, he said, he's told the church's governing board, the pastor's council, this might be something we have to deal with again 2 months from now. We just have to be nimble in the way we do things and be ready. If we have to go back online once again, we'll do that. Stevens compared the church's situation to that of all kinds of businesses and school systems across the state, where buildings are opening and then superintendents temporarily close individual schools because of COVID-19 outbreaks. The problem is not unique to the church, but the church is getting a black eye, Stevens said. We feel like church is an integral part of our world right now. We don't want to be reckless with people's lives. We don't have a rebellion-driven agenda here. We just believe that people need to hear something positive and reassuring. Not all churches are as careful. On Friday, RFA Church on Yonkers Road in Raleigh hosted Evangelicals for Trump, Praise, Prayer, and Patriotism with President Donald Trump's son Eric and the president's spiritual advisor Paula White. The event, held in the church sanctuary, had elements of both a religious gathering and a rally, both of which fall under the category of community events in the state's cluster tracking. Between 400 and 500 people attended. As they waited to enter the building, people wearing T-shirts identifying them as church event staff checked to make sure those entering had face masks. When people asked if they had to wear the masks, they were told the masks should be worn when in the presence of media there to cover the event. Inside, very few people wore masks. About half the crowd had chairs in front of the stage, most a foot or two apart, and others sat next to each other in arena-style seating on risers. A praise band sang, and many in the crowd sang along unmasked. When Eric Trump and others spoke, they cheered and shouted. Jennifer Copeland, executive director of the North Carolina Council of Churches, which has members from 18 denominations, said her organization is encouraging churches to be cautious about regathering. Copeland said she understands that people are experiencing what some have called COVID fatigue. They're tired of being isolated and of being kept from doing things that feel normal. But just because churches are allowed to gather, she said, doesn't mean they should. Doing so, Copeland said, is a poor example of exercising the faith imperative to care more about the community than we do about ourselves. Everywhere you turn in Scripture, God is asking us to put others first, to put the community needs first. If you have one group of people who feel like they can do whatever they want to do, then the community is in danger. For now, Copeland said, the Council of Churches is still in the phase where we believe that loving our neighbors means keeping our distance from them. Gathering together, singing together, drinking from the communion cup, these are things we are willing to forego in order to show our love for our neighbors. We'll continue on Religion in the News with an article from the Washington Post, October 25th edition. This is entitled, Pope Francis Names Washington Archbishop Wilton Gregory First African-American Cardinal. This article is by Chico Harlan, Michelle Borstein, and Anne E. Merrimow of the Washington Post, Dateline Rome. Pope Francis will elevate Archbishop Wilton Gregory of Washington to cardinal next month, making him the first African-American to hold the title. Gregory is one of 13 cardinals in the new class Francis announced Sunday, a promotion that comes as he is trying to rebuild trust in an archdiocese rocked by sexual abuse cases. The move was widely anticipated. Washington archbishops are typically elevated to cardinal after their appointments. But it is nonetheless symbolically significant in the U.S. Catholic Church, where black people have been underrepresented among the leadership. The new cardinal is a caring pastor, a quiet leader, and a courageous voice when Washington and the country need all three, said John Carr, who worked with Gregory for 20 years when Carr was a lobbyist for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. At a time when racism is tearing our country apart, he has been a consistent, persistent voice for the dignity of all, for black lives, and for racial justice and reconciliation, said Carr, director of the Initiative on Catholic Social Thought and Public Life at Georgetown University. We need healing, and for Pope Francis to recognize his leadership is a hopeful sign. Gregory, age 72, was appointed Archbishop of Washington last year to take over for Cardinal Donald Wuerl, who had been accused of mishandling clerical abuse cases. As a cardinal, Gregory will be eligible to vote in any papal election until he reaches the cutoff age of 80. Francis announced the names of his new cardinals from a window overlooking St. Peter's Square, where he delivers his Sunday Angelus. The Vatican said the ceremony to elevate the new cardinals, called a consistory, would take place November 28th, but it was unclear whether tightening coronavirus restrictions in Italy might interfere. Among the other cardinals, four are already over 80, according to the Vatican. The new cardinals include Marcello Semeraro, an Italian who was recently appointed head of the church's saint-making body, and Antoine Kambanda, the Archbishop of Kigali, Rwanda. Gregory has long been among the most prominent Catholic leaders in the United States, having led the Conference of Bishops in the early 2000s when it was making its first attempt to draw up anti-abuse guidelines. Gregory was Archbishop of Atlanta before coming to Washington. With a very grateful and humble heart, I thank Pope Francis for this appointment, which will allow me to work more closely with him in caring for Christ's Church, Gregory said in a statement, according to the Catholic Standard, the Washington Archdiocese's newspaper. The Catholic Church has a strong presence in Washington's black community, including its sizable middle class. Black Catholics make up about 13% of the Washington Archdiocese, which includes D.C. and its Maryland suburbs, compared with about 3% for the nation as a whole. Many black city leaders are Catholic or went to Catholic schools, including Mayor Muriel E. Bowser, Democrat, and her predecessors, Adrian Fenty, Democrat, and Anthony A. Williams, Democrat, as well as D.C. Council members Vincent C. Gray, Ward 7, and Robert C. White, Jr., at large, and Attorney General Carl A. Racine, all Democrats. From his purview in the nation's capital, Gregory has faced challenges beyond the church in a year of rising racial tensions nationwide, including some that have played out in his new city. One of the most visible occurred this summer, when President Trump and the First Lady visited a D.C. shrine to Pope John Paul II. The visit came days after law enforcement used rubber bullets and tear gas to clear peaceful protesters outside of the White House so Trump could have a controversial photo op in front of St. John's Church holding a Bible. Gregory said of the shrine and its leadership that it was baffling and reprehensible that any Catholic facility would allow itself to be so egregiously misused and manipulated in a fashion that violates our religious principles, which call us to defend the rights of all people, even those with whom we might disagree. In a statement then, Gregory noted that Pope John Paul II would not have condoned Trump's actions at St. John's. St. Pope John Paul II was an ardent defender of the rights and dignity of human beings. His legacy bears vivid witness to that truth, Gregory said. He certainly would not condone the use of tear gas and other deterrents to silence, scatter, or intimidate them for a photo opportunity in front of a place of worship and peace. Gregory was also among Catholic leaders in Maryland this summer who signed a letter on racial justice that highlighted black Catholics who have over the centuries led efforts for justice, even when the institutional church was lagging in resistance. With regret and humility, we must recognize that as Catholic leaders and as an institution, we have at times not followed the gospel to which we profess and have been too slow in correcting our shortcomings. For this reason, it is incumbent upon us to place ourselves at the forefront of efforts to remove the inequalities and discrimination that are still present in Maryland and our nation today, the letter read. Prayer and dialogue alone are not enough. We must act to bring about true change on issues including health care, housing, and criminal justice reform. The question for Gregory is how or if he should step out more in D.C. and now nationally as cardinal at a time of intense division. The divisions among Catholics in the United States mirror the population as a whole. Whether on issues of race, abortion, Trump, or a border wall, Catholics are divided based on partisanship, not on the teachings of their church. Gregory's critique of Trump's actions this summer, for instance, drew criticism from a conservative Catholic publication. Anthea Butler, a religious history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, pushed back against such criticism and described Gregory as consistently moderate and mainstream. His higher profile, she said, will allow him to speak out strongly and command the respect of the title of cardinal. This gives him a lot more power to say certain things, especially with regards to race, said Butler, who writes about race in the Catholic Church. He will be a voice for social justice and a voice in the middle of the pandemic talking about poverty. Gregory's historic promotion was celebrated Sunday at many Catholic services in the D.C. region. When the Reverend Everett Pearson shared the news at Mass, his predominantly black congregation in Maryland stood to applaud and shouted with joy before pausing to say a prayer for Gregory. Pearson called the elevation long overdue and said that black Catholics have for too long been placed in the back of the church, their culture drowned out by a Euro-Catholic standard. We finally have someone who looks like me, who grew up like me, and can embrace his African-American heritage, said Pearson, who leads Mount Calvary Catholic Church in Forestville. We've now got an opportunity to at least come to the table. Gregory happened to lead a service at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Largo, Maryland, on Saturday. Bishop Roy Campbell, who leads the church, said Gregory is accessible and open, and Campbell hopes he continues to speak the truth. Before coming to Washington, Gregory was known for being diplomatic and mild-mannered. He has since become a bit more outspoken in moments that bring together religion, politics, and race. After the killing of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, Gregory mentioned similar moments and said incidents of police brutality were tragically repeating. The killing of Floyd and others, Gregory said, clearly confirms that racism still endures in our country. Gregory, whose parents were Baptist and who converted as a child to Catholicism, has been a pioneer. He was one of the youngest bishops when he was named as one at age 36 and is still the country's only black archbishop. He has been known as a moderate on political issues, including race. However, experts on the history of black Catholicism say he embraced the spiritual revolution taking off after the 1960s. In the 1980s, Gregory helped create a hymnal that would become the standard for black parishes. But he did not side with the aims of a more radical group of black priests who declared the church a white racist institution, said Matthew Kressler, a religious studies professor at the College of Charleston, who wrote a book about black Catholicism in the United States. It's a given he lives with contentment and doesn't draw attention to race, Monsignor Kevin Irwin, a professor and former theology school dean at Catholic University, who became close friends with Gregory in 1975 while they were doctoral students in Rome, told the Washington Post for a profile last year. Continuing on religion in the news this week, this article from the Associated Press dated October 29th, Three Dead in Attack at French Church, Country on High Alert. And this is by Laurie Hinnant of the AP, Dateline Paris. An attacker armed with a knife killed three people inside a church Thursday in the Mediterranean city of Nice, prompting the government to raise its security alert status to the highest level and double the number of soldiers deployed in the country. It was the third attack in 2 months in France that authorities have attributed to Muslim extremists, including the beheading of a teacher. It comes during a growing furor over caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad that were republished by the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo, renewing vociferous debate in France and the Muslim world over the depictions that Muslims consider offensive but are protected by French free speech laws. Other confrontations and attacks were reported Thursday in the southern French city of Avignon and in the Saudi city of Jeddah, but it was not immediately clear if they were linked to the attack in Nice. French President Emmanuel Macron said he would immediately increase the number of soldiers deployed to protect schools and religious sites from around 3,000 currently to 7,000. French churches have been ferociously attacked by extremists in recent years, and Thursday's killings come ahead of the Roman Catholic All Saints holiday. He cried Allah Akbar over and over even after he was injured, said Nice Mayor Christian Estrosi, who said a woman and a man died inside the church, while a second woman fled to a nearby bar but was mortally wounded. The meaning of his gesture left no doubt. The assailant in Nice was wounded by police and hospitalized after the killings at the Notre Dame Basilica, less than a kilometer or half mile from the site in 2016, where another attacker plowed a truck into a Bastille Day crowd, killing dozens of people. Shots punctuated the air and witnesses screamed as police stationed at the grandiose doors to the church appeared to fire at the attacker inside, according to videos obtained by the Associated Press. Hours later, AP reporters at the scene saw emergency vehicles and police tape lining the wide Notre Dame Avenue leading toward the plaza in front of the basilica. For a time after the attack, sounds of explosions could be heard as sappers exploded suspicious devices. France's anti-terrorism prosecutor's office opened an investigation into the attack, the third one since a trial opened in September for people linked to the 2015 attacks at Charlie Hebdo and a kosher supermarket by gunmen who claimed allegiance to the Islamic State group and Al-Qaeda. The trial is nearing its end, with a verdict planned for November 13th, the fifth anniversary of another series of deadly Islamic State attacks in Paris. Thursday's attacker was believed to be acting alone, and police are not searching for other assailants, said two police officials who are not authorized to be publicly named. With the attack against teacher Samuel Paty, it was freedom of speech that was targeted. With this attack in Nice, it is freedom of religion, Prime Minister Jean Castex told lawmakers Thursday. Earlier, the lower house of parliament suspended a debate on France's new virus restrictions and held a moment of silence for the victims. Castex rushed from the hall to a crisis center overseeing the aftermath of the Nice attack and later returned to announce the alert level increase. French President Emmanuel Macron, who has defended Charlie Hebdo's right to publish the caricatures, arrived in Nice later in the day. Muslims have held protests in several countries and called for a boycott of French goods in response to France's stance on caricatures of Islam's most revered prophet, whose birthday was marked in several countries Thursday. Soon before Thursday's attack, supporters of religious political party Jamiat Ulema-e-Islam protested in Pakistan against Macron. In Avignon on Thursday morning, an armed man was shot to death by police after he refused to drop his weapon and a flashball shot failed to stop him, one police official said. And a Saudi state-run news agency said a man stabbed a guard at the French consulate in Jeddah, wounding the guard before he was arrested. Islamic State extremists had issued a video on Wednesday renewing calls for attacks against France. Many groups and nations, however, issued their condolences Thursday, standing firmly with France. The French Council of the Muslim Faith condemned the Nice attack and called on French Muslims to refrain from festivities this week, marking the birth of Mohammed, as a sign of mourning and in solidarity with the victims and their loved ones. Turkey's foreign ministry strongly condemned the attack in Nice. We stand in solidarity with the people of France against terror and violence, the statement said. Relations between Turkey and France hit a new low after Turkey's president on Saturday accused Macron of Islamophobia over the caricatures and questioned his mental health, prompting Paris to recall its ambassador to Turkey for consultations. The attack in Nice came less than 2 weeks after another assailant beheaded a French middle school teacher who showed the caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad and for a class on free speech. Those caricatures were published by Charlie Hebdo and cited by the men who gunned down the newspaper's editorial meeting in 2015. In September, a man who had sought asylum in France attacked bystanders outside Charlie Hebdo's former offices with a butcher knife. French Roman Catholic sites have been ferociously and repeatedly targeted by extremists in recent years, including the killing of the Reverend Jacques Hamel, who had his throat slit while celebrating Mass in his Normandy church by Islamic militants, and a plot to bomb Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Those attacks were claimed by the Islamic State group, which also is believed to have recruited a man now on trial who plotted unsuccessfully to attack a church on the outskirts of Paris. Nice's 19th-century basilica Notre-Dame de l'Assomption is the largest church in the city, but smaller and newer than the cathedral 1 mile away. The basilica's twin neo-Gothic towers, standing 70 yards high, are a landmark feature in the heart of the city. Next on religion in the news, this article from Religion News Service, dated October 27th, with rising COVID-19 cases inside the Vatican, pressure mounts for Francis to don a mask. This is by Claire Jean Gravy of RNS, Dateline Vatican City. While the Vatican's COVID-19 Commission attempts to tangibly address the consequences of the pandemic, it struggled to explain Tuesday why its boss, Pope Francis, is so often seen without a mask. "We are trying to convince him to wear a mask," said the Reverend Augusto Zampini, adjunct secretary of the Vatican Department for Promoting Integral Human Development and one of the coordinators of the Vatican COVID-19 Commission. "He has started wearing a mask now," Zampini added during Tuesday's virtual news conference. Pope Francis has been facing mounting criticism for often attending gatherings at the Vatican, even indoors, without wearing a protective mask. Photos and videos show him at public events disregarding social distancing measures and precautions. Zampini said when the Pope speaks on video or attends large open-air events, he keeps his distance and follows the precautions put in place at the Vatican, which enforces social distancing and mask wearing. He also observed that at age 83, Pope Francis is at high risk if something happens. Behind the protection of its walls and with a limited citizenship, the Vatican was almost isolated in the first months of the pandemic in Italy, Zampini said. But the situation is different today, with 27 positive cases inside Vatican City. A Vatican statement last week reported the newest case inside the Domus Sancte Marthe, where Pope Francis currently resides. This is the second case to emerge in the Pope's own home after a prelate tested positive last March. Only a few days prior, the Vatican announced a COVID-19 outbreak among its security forces, with 11 Swiss guards testing positive for the virus. The Vatican reported no fatalities due to the pandemic so far, and 15 people who previously tested positive are now COVID-19 free. After the spike in cases inside the Vatican and in nearby regions of Italy, Francis adopted stricter rules to prevent contagion. The Pope expressed his disappointment for having to be distant from the faithful, especially the disabled and children, who would often gather around him in St. Peter's Square. "I apologize if I meet you at a distance," Pope Francis said during his weekly general audience October 14th, "but I believe that if we all follow the instructions from the authorities like good citizens, it will be a help in putting an end to this pandemic." Zampini said the commission is totally aware of the prophetic role that the Catholic Church has to play now and voiced concern for the rising cases. He pointed out that the Vatican, like any other institution in the world, has been hard hit by the pandemic, both from an economic and a safety perspective. While the commission offers suggestions to Pope Francis and other Vatican departments, Zampini said, his focus is primarily in promoting the cause of the poor and vulnerable members of the community by influencing scientific and political decision makers. Pope Francis created the COVID-19 Commission in the early days of the pandemic with the purpose of promoting radical change in our society and politics, Zampini said. The Pope's recent speech to the United Nations, his TED Talk, and his encyclical Fratelli Tutti, Brothers All, come together to outline Francis's vision for a future after the pandemic. The Pope gave us a mission impossible, Zampini said, adding that the Commission reports its findings and operations to the Pontiff once a week. Echoing the words of Pope Francis, Zampini said the pandemic has exacerbated all the previous crises and highlighted the inability of nations to come together for a common purpose. He said the commission is attempting to gather religious leaders for an event to stand together in solidarity. The commission put an emphasis on collaborating with local churches, networking with international organizations, establishing relationships with nations, and fundraising. Through its initiatives with the Catholic charitable organization Caritas, or global institutions such as the United Nations, the Commission has been able to reach more than 5 million people and raise over $7 million. Sister Alessandra Smerilli, who teaches economy at the Auxilium University in Rome and coordinates with the Commission, said at Tuesday's virtual conference that the question of COVID-19 vaccines is central to the work of the Vatican Task Force. "Vaccines must not become a new arms race," she said, "nor should they become a new weapon." The impact the pandemic has had on women and their role in finding solutions and proposals are also important to the commission, Smerilli said, which plans to compile a report by the end of the month. Smerilli, who is among the most authoritative female voices in the Vatican, also had a word of caution for the many protests that have occurred in Italy and elsewhere, denouncing the new wave of restrictions enacted to limit the spread of the pandemic. "The commission is dedicated to helping those who are struggling the most because of the virus," she said, "but we mustn't throw gas on the flame at this time." We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We hope you've enjoyed the program, and thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that previous editions, including this one of Religion in the News, are available at our website. Visit ncreadingservice.org and click Listen, then click Podcasts to find archived editions of Religion in the News. And we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.